Hello everybody and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report with me, John Arola. And very soon, two guests who joined us before, one joining us for the first time in studio, British journalist Billy Porter is gonna be joining us to break down the future of the Labour Party and other related issues going on in the UK right now, including the next steps in Brexit, which are coming up very soon. We've got updates on the protests in Iran. We've got another little petty corruption case involving Jared Kushner and obstruction of journalistic investigations of what actually is going on there. It's gonna be fun. Let's touch base with that. And we're gonna be closing out the show with Meanwhile In. We've got news on polar bears, the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean, and some ridiculous things going on down at the border involving Donald Trump's border wall. But before we get to all of that, something happened yesterday in the defense of Donald Trump in the impeachment trial that I found simply unacceptable. So we're gonna focus the beginning of the show on that. Alan Dershowitz spoke yesterday in support of Donald Trump, and he said a lot of really insane things that if people accept the argument he's making, particularly if our senators accept it, it says some pretty dangerous things about the future of America, our presidency, our democracy, our system of government. I wanna jump into it. We got a few different video clips here. I'm gonna save the worst for last, so stay tuned for that. But first, here is Alan Dershowitz's little hypothetical to help people understand what's going on.
What if a Democratic president were to be elected and Congress were to authorize much money to either Israel or the Palestinians, and the Democratic president were to say to Israel, no, I'm going to withhold this money unless you stop all settlement growth, or to the Palestinians, I will withhold the money Congress authorized to you unless you stop paying terrorists. And the president said, quid pro quo. If you don't do it, you don't get the money. If you do it, you get the money. There's no one in this chamber that would regard that as in any way unlawful.
Well, perhaps not in that chamber. Our standards for our senators has just dropped lower and lower with every passing years, with every passing year. But it's certainly, even that hypothetical, which is supposed to, it's not what's going on with Donald Trump. And I'll make that clear how. But even that hypothetical, that should not be acceptable, even if the foreign policy goal that was being pursued there is reasonable. Both of the hypotheticals he gave, the stopping the settlement building, the stopping funding for terrorists, all of that, both laudable goals. It is not the province of the president to take legally allocated funding and say, oh, this is designated to accomplish the goals that the legislature is pursuing. No, we're not doing that. In fact, I'm gonna add my own personal thing. Would that be a quid pro quo? Yes. Would it be unlawful? Yes, it would still be unlawful. As the GEO has already made clear, the US government's top internal watchdog concluded earlier this month that the Trump administration broke the law when it withheld military aid to Ukraine last year. And in those hypotheticals that Dershowitz lays out, it would be the same. It is not just unethical, which it is, which he doesn't believe it is, but it is. It is also illegal. And so as we go through the rest of his arguments, remember that all of these things that he's saying are not illegal, they've already been shown to be illegal, not just hypothetically, but the situation we're currently in. But way more important even than that, the example he gave was designed to bamboozle you in a very clear way. He gave two hypotheticals about future presidents engaging in quid pro quos, and he wanted to convince you that like, hey, those are good, so why isn't this one good? But in both of the hypotheticals he gave, even though they're unethical and even though they are illegal, no matter what he says, they're also not representative of the scandal we're involved in right now. Because in both of those cases, the hypothetical is taking legally allocated aid designed to accomplish foreign policy goals and adding another quid pro quo on top of that, that is designed to accomplish a foreign policy goal. Nowhere in his examples did he provide something that was of the personal, sole personal political interest of the president, which is what we're talking about. Donald Trump was not pursuing his own foreign policy goals for the betterment of America, that he just had a disagreement with the legislature. This was entirely personal to him. And Dershowitz is being fundamentally dishonest in his examples when he provides examples that don't have anything to do with personal political interest. So here is something ridiculous too. To give you an idea of this guy who still has a reputation as being this great legal mind, take a look at this doozy.
The only thing that would make a quid pro quo unlawful is if the quo were in some way illegal.
Okay, so the only thing that would make a quid pro quo unlawful is if the quo was illegal. Well, yes, it is unlawful if it's illegal. Everybody understands that. What are you talking about? But very importantly, he is missing that in the example he's talking about, it is illegal. The GEO has already said he's broken the law. You're not allowed to do that. There is so much implicit like expectation and entitlement of executive authority that underlies everything that these Trump supporters are saying. It doesn't matter what the GEO or any other watchdog agency is saying. It doesn't matter what the law is saying. We see an America where the president, or at least our president, the one in our party, can do anything he wants, and how dare you assert otherwise. I feel like this is an opportunity for us to stand up and say, no, that is not the system we want. We don't want an all-powerful president, whether he's of our party or the other party. It is supposed to be a balanced system. Now, importantly, he seems to understand previously, when I was talking about how his hypothetical is not representative of what's going on, he does seem to get that fundamentally in some level, as he'll sketch out in this video.
There are three possible motives that a political figure can have. One, a motive in the public interest, and the Israel argument would be in the public interest. The second is in his own political interest, and the third, which hasn't been mentioned, would be in his own financial interest, his own pure financial interest, just putting money in the bank.
Okay, so Dershowitz does get that there are different motivations that can all lead to a quid pro quo, loosely defined. One is an actual foreign policy interest of the country, whether you agree with it or not. The other is personal political. The third is personal and economic. I want you to bear in mind as we move forward with this impeachment inquiry that for literally years, up to and including today and the rest of his term, we've given him all of the personal economic interests for free. He can do anything he wants, domestically, internationally, taking money from leaders, it being funneled into his organization in any number of different ways. We've given him all of those for free, even though the Constitution very specifically does not allow for that. We are focusing on the second one because we're worried about the precedent that is being set in terms of manipulations of elections. So Dershowitz does appear to get that, but he's immediately gonna jettison that understanding as he lays out this. This is the last video we're gonna show you. This should terrify you. Let's take a look.
I want to focus on the second one for just one moment. Every public official that I know believes that his election is in the public interest. And mostly you're right. Your election is in the public interest. And if a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
That is absurd. That is exactly the sort of quid pro quo that should lead to impeachment. So he's saying, if a politician thinks that doing X raises the chance of me being elected, and if I, an awesome guy, are good for the country, then anything done in pursuit of re-election is thereby allowed. It has to be. It's not my personal interest anymore. It's the country's interest, because think about how much the country would be damaged if they didn't have me around anymore. Dershowitz is being brought out, not as one of the sort of like partisan political hacks that are gonna defend him in a legal sense. He is being trotted out specifically as an expert on the Constitution. A legal mind that has such a history and so much baked in respect that we're supposed to just buy what he says about this. And he has somehow gone beyond any of the others, the Zeldins and the Cruises and the Grahams and Sekulow and I know all of them, and said the most bat-ass crazy thing that I've heard. He says, if it's done in pursuit of getting election, how could it possibly be wrong? That's Nixonian to its core, the idea that you could do anything. Well, in that case, any sort of quid pro quo internationally, taking our American foreign policy, military aid, whatever, and just turning it over to your reelection effort will always be allowed. So, you know, if Bernie Sanders is running for reelection someday, he should definitely do that, totally allowed. The Republicans are laying the case out right now. Obama honestly should have done it. Why did he have to have a difficult reelection battle when he could have just rigged things in his favor? It's in the public interest after all. No, but like fundamentally, I know that this is gonna seem like an exaggeration, but this really is a time when we have to decide, do we want a president that is bound by the Constitution and checks and balances provided by the two other branches of government, or do we want a king who decides totally of himself that his presence is a public good and any criminality is justified so long as he maintains his position, that his own personal interest, because of an act of sheer will, becomes the national interest? Is absurd, and we need to be very clear about that. Unfortunately, it looks like the process whereby we would make that clear by removing him from office is probably not going to happen, because far too many of our elected representatives believe that we should have a king and his will should be the national policy. But this whole thing is both absurd, scary, setting a terrible precedent. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. Stick around after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Just a few weeks ago, Iran was gripped by massive protests after the downing of a passenger jet. And joining us now to help catch us up on what's been going on since then and what might happen in Iran in the near future is Iranian-American journalist and media analyst Nagar Mortazavi. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So since the big protests that we talked about previously, I haven't seen too much reporting about what's been going on. If there's been any sort of continuing unrest, are people feeling reassured about that there won't be a repeat of the passenger jet being shot down? Can you catch us up a little bit on the domestic situation there?
Sure. So the grievances are certainly there, as we saw back in November, the massive protests, massive anti-government protests happening in almost 100 cities across Iran, and hundreds of people killed by security forces. That was wrapped up with the repression, but the grievances remained. And then we saw the next round of protests just a few weeks ago, as you said, in reaction, in direct response to the downing of the civilian plane, and then the following cover up for 3 days when the government lied about it. But what we're hearing right now, so the protests from the street have been wrapped up again by security forces. But right now, the talk of Iranian politics is mostly the domestic rift between political factions, because we have a parliamentary election coming up in February. It's an important election that seems like the hardliners are trying to basically clean up house and create a more unified hardline parliamentary, get rid of the moderate and the reformist voices as much as they can, bring some fresh new blood, but still from the hardline camp. We've seen a big number of reformist candidates being disqualified to run by the Guardian Council, who is also controlled by the hardliners. So it seems like the upcoming parliamentary elections in February is going to be the next game changer, and then followed by the presidential election the year after.
So I want to ask you a little bit about those disqualifications. I know that this is not the first time it's happened, but it seems like a lot of candidates being disqualified, dozens and dozens of actual current lawmakers being disqualified. How significant is that? And should we expect that there will be any unrest either in the wake of the election or in particular if it seems like it was not a fair process?
Well, it definitely seems like it wasn't a rare process. It's basically using the disqualification to get rid of your domestic rivals is what the hardliners are doing. And some of the reformists and more moderate forces that have been disqualified are just longtime politicians who've been in the game. And it just comes as a very big surprise that the hardliners took this very bold step to disqualify them from running. Let's also remember that some of the moderate and reformist forces, these are considered domestic opposition to the to the hardliners, some of them actually refrained from running. So a smaller number boycotted the election in light of the recent events of the repression of protesters and all that. So the combination of all of this, just to give you the big picture, the combination of all of this is that we're going to see a more weakened moderate slash reformist force. These are the forces who want more engagement with the West, who want better relations, more trade, more opening, potential diplomacy with the US, with Europe. And we're going to see a more strengthened hardline camp. We already see the IRGC becoming stronger thanks to President Trump's policies in the region. And now we're going to see that basically being mirrored in a way in the parliament through the elections and then possibly at the presidential election the next year.
And I know that this is speculation at this point, but if that's, you know, the government that's going to exist, what do you think the people will think about that? I mean, there's been these massive waves of protest. Is that the sort of thing that could trigger more like some sort of popular uprising?
Well, it could, because as I said, the grievances are there. But then at the same time, when the hardliners have the upper hand and they keep getting stronger and they isolate the moderates and the reformists, that means we're going to see more repression. So it doesn't mean that more protests are going to lead to meaningful change, more towards democracy or freedom. It's probably going to mean that we're going to see a more closed political space. We're going to see more state repression. And with the threat that's coming from the outside, President Trump's assassination of the top general, Qasem Soleimani, was seen as an act of war by the Iranians, a major escalation. All of that is also affecting the domestic politics. And now any criticism of the hardliners, criticism of the IRGC, of the Quds Force that was run by Qasem Soleimani, of Iran's regional activities is going to be seen basically with more scrutiny, considered treason. And there's already hardline pundits calling on domestic critics, calling them basically rented mouthpieces for Trump and Netanyahu. So we're going to see for sure a more closing of the political space. And that's just not good news for the factions that want better change and also for the population.
You know, you mentioned Trump and Netanyahu there. I wanted to get your reaction to Iranian leaders condemning the peace plan that Trump rolled out earlier this week. They referred to it as shameful, the treason of the century, and doomed to fail. I guess perhaps we're not too surprised that the Iranian leadership is not fans of the plan, but I would like to get your reaction. And will the position of the Iranian leadership on this, could that help a little bit in terms of public opinion, that maybe the public agrees with them on this position, that can help to buttress their position?
I'm not sure. I mean, they're not considered real important game changers or players when it comes to all of this Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As far as the peace plan right now, they may have some sway over Hamas, definitely not the Palestinian leadership, Mahmoud Abbas and all in the West Bank. But we also hear the same reaction from the Palestinians. The Palestinian leader called this the slap of the century. The Arab League has rejected it. And it seems like Iranians have basically tried to take the Palestinians back when some other Arab countries like this, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Egypt seem to somehow be pushing the Palestinians to accept this plan or at least consider it. So it's another basically door to more chaos in the region that President Trump is going to open, similar to his policy on Iran. We haven't seen any much de-escalation of tensions. We've only seen an increase, incremental increasing of tensions over the past 2 years. He unraveled the nuclear deal. He promised a new one. We haven't seen it. He assassinated this top general, which is now going to make the Iranians act more aggressively in the region. And now with this Palestinian issue, we're probably going to see more chaos in that area as well.
Nagar, as always, we appreciate you joining us, helping break down these sometimes complicated stories. We appreciate your perspective.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
We're going to take a short break here. Lots more after this. Okay, so this entire impeachment thing all stems from Donald Trump wanting to have a story during the election about corruption involving the person he thought he'd be running against, Joe Biden. Here's the crazy thing. Imagine a world in which there were stories of corruption about Donald Trump and his administration. I know it seems crazy, but like it could potentially happen if we actually were allowed to know what was going on. But the thing is, they block information. I've got a great example of it. I'm not saying this is a story that is definitely corrupt or proves that corrupt things were happening, but it doesn't look good and we don't get to know what was actually going on. So let's jump back a few years and we're gonna catch up and see what's going on involving Jared Kushner in this case. Back in November 2017, Trump was on a 12-day tour through Asia, his second major international trip since he became president. He was doing all these things in Beijing, bilateral meetings, meet and greets, speeches. All of that, that's all official and on the agenda. But one thing wasn't on the presidential agenda. That was a meeting with private equity investors convened by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, and US Ambassador Terry Branstad. So this was not just a meeting that Jared Kushner was at, it was a meeting he put together. And not with government officials, but private equity investors, which is interesting considering the Kushner family's like business interests around real estate and all of that. So at the time of the meeting, the Kushner family was under fire for its pursuit of overseas investors, while Jared Kushner occupied a senior role advising the president. So that's the concerns about the family. Now Kushner reportedly divested his stock in the family business and his siblings took over. So obviously, if he's not personally gonna financially benefit, why would he care about what happens to his family's business? Now interestingly, in the months immediately prior to that meeting, his sister, Nicole Kushner Meyer, referred to Jared at an event that was urging wealthy Chinese investors to buy $500,000 visas to come to the US and participate in an upcoming New Jersey project. So his family is under like a lot of suspicion about them looking into this, the international potential investors. His sister specifically mentions him to try to get them to spend tons of money to come work potentially with the Kushners on real estate. He goes on a trip in an official government capacity, not a business capacity, official government capacity with Donald Trump, and then meets off the books with private equity investors. Now again, I don't know for sure what was done in that meeting, but it certainly doesn't look good considering all of the stuff involving Kushner's family and the propensity of everyone in the Trump administration to self-deal in these sorts of things. So here's the thing, thankfully CNBC, to their credit, they have been trying to find out what actually happened in that meeting. They sought to learn about the agenda at the private investor meeting convened by Jared Kushner. A White House official had subsequently confirmed the existence of the meeting to CNBC, but when pressed to say who was there, the official would only say that no real estate investors were present. And the White House and the State Department did not respond to additional requests for information about the meeting. They were probably just busy. So back then, and we're talking about a couple of years, CNBC is like, okay, that's suspicious and they're not gonna tell us willingly what's going on. So they filed a request under the Freedom of Information Act with the State Department, requesting online and analog communications among the officials that were present at that meeting, as well as information about who was actually present. So the State Department acknowledged the request in December of 2017, but suggested that getting the information would probably take a long time because of the quote, unusual circumstances around the request. Now, if you read that sentence and you wonder, what are you talking about? Unusual circumstances. We want the information. That's what FOIA is for. It's not unusual, it's usual. I don't know. They didn't provide any additional information. CNBC went back and forth with the State Department for more than a year trying to get the information, and they refused to actually do so. Now, I want you to bear in mind, during the first 2 years of the Trump administration, the State Department processed 83% of self-described complex FOIA requests in less than 400 days. So almost always, even if it's complex, it takes less than 400 days. Now look, that's still a really long time, but at least you'll get the information. They've been going back and forth for like close to 2 years now since that meeting. Last October, the State Department finally provided a date when they will provide the information. You wanna know what it is? July 23rd, 2021. 3.5 years after the initial filing. That's way over 1,000 days. And interestingly, happens on the other side of the 2020 presidential election, which is certainly convenient. Why is it so complicated to turn over some emails? Well, it's not complicated administratively, but it might be complicated politically because it probably would look really bad. And the last thing Donald Trump wants hurting him is a corruption scandal involving someone's nephew or her son or whatever. And that's what he has on his hands. And again, I cannot say that anything truly corrupt happened at this meeting. But when you look at the process, how resistant they've been to anyone finding out what happened there, the fact that they're pushing it way past the next election, that has the appearance of just outright corruption. I think we can all agree on that there. And this is the sort of benign, like you're not gonna hear about this story again. It just pops up now. Maybe someday we'll find out the information. It'll look really bad in 2021 if he's president then. But are they gonna do anything? No, of course they're not gonna do anything. It's just totally allowed corruption. And we move on with American democracy. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Billy Porter, British journalist and filmmaker, is gonna be in studio. We're gonna break down a whole bunch of interesting stories for you. Turning now to the United Kingdom, things are moving fast, both internally in the Labour Party, looking to its future, but also what's going on with Brexit. We got some updates coming on very soon. And joining us in studio for the first time, British journalist and filmmaker Billy Porter. Welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. We've talked previously about what's been going on over there. There's a lot to talk about now. And I wanted to start off with the Labour Party. Obviously, some rough times very recently.
Yeah.
And so looking to the future strategically, philosophically, what are some of the things that we can expect coming up?
Well, so we're in the midst of a Labour leadership race right now, which is kind of like beginning to hot up. There are three official candidates in the race and then a further one who is trying to get the necessary backing to actually make it onto the final ballot. It's a bit of a somewhat confusing system. You need to have backing from two unions and a Labour affiliate to actually be included in the vote. Mm-hmm.
Very different than our system in terms of how we pick. Backing helps, but it's not as formalized.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess probably the most, the candidate that will resonate most with the Young Turks audience would be Rebecca Long-Bailey. She is by far the most sort of left-leaning progressive candidate. Very, very staunch Jeremy Corbyn supporter. But for that reason, I think lots of people are questioning whether or not she will actually be able to win it. Like, is it too similar to Corbyn? And obviously that just went horribly wrong.
So really fast on that. I don't follow a ton of British media, but I am assuming the sort of popular wisdom right now is they lost because they went in this direction. They would be fools to do it again, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as someone like myself, and I'm sure you.
That's, I mean, the media's perspective. I'm not talking about my perspective.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think that obviously lots of people have dissected it, and there are a number of things that could potentially be to blame. I think that was Jeremy Corbyn too far left, or was the way that he was treated by the media really to blame? I think like his persona was more the problem than the man himself. I think, you know, he was victim to just unrelenting attacks from all sorts of media outlets across the political spectrum, including those that were supposed to be impartial.
Okay, so the analogy to Bernie Sanders is pretty robust then.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of that as well.
Yeah.
So for her, she philosophically agrees with him quite a bit, but hypothetically doesn't have the same persona. So to say that she would inevitably lead to the same outcome might be missing the distinction between the two candidates, partially media created.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, she's also a working class woman from the north. She represents a demographic that the Labour Party lost in the last election. I think that also, it's like high time that the Labour Party did have a female leader. There have been two female leaders of the Conservative Party. It feels pretty backwards that we haven't had one.
Yeah, exactly. And backwards from sort of the analogy to American politics. So, but what about the voters, the supporters of the Labour Party? What do they actually want?
I mean, Keir Starmer is favorite to win. He's the more sort of centrist, soft left option. But But I think that what's happening is that lots of people are trying to predict who will win in the event of another snap election if we don't have a conservative government, you know, until 2024, which I obviously hope doesn't happen. Will he be more likely to summon the votes and actually bring us a Labour government? So it's, you know, it's tactical in that way. I think people are looking for someone who will actually resonate with the public and be likely to win an election as opposed to people who align with their personal politics.
Do you think that he is that candidate?
I mean, he's the sort of yes man, seems to be appeasing both sides of the Labour Party, and potentially for that reason might be able to win a majority, I suppose. But it seems pretty hard to determine what his actual views are because he just seems to agree with anyone in the moment.
It can be successful in the short term politically, but incredibly frustrating if you're really tapped into what's going on.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, what's going to happen in the UK in the near future. One of the things that is, of course, going to happen is the next step in Brexit, a fairly significant one. So what's actually going to happen later this week?
Well, yeah, tomorrow, isn't it?
Finally. Oh, I guess it is tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh, Friday's coming up soon. Okay, good news here on the Damage Report. So what is actually going to happen?
I mean, I guess in terms of how are people's day-to-day lives going to change after tomorrow night, I don't think it's going to be very sort of tangible, but it is really now the point of no return. There's no turning back. We can't reverse this. If we ever want to re-enter the EU, then we have to reapply, and I don't know why they would let us back in. I don't know if you saw that Nigel Farage had this like utterly like such an ugly display at the EU parliamentary debate the other day, sort of waving around a Union Jack flag and making loads of very awful jokes really shortly after an Auschwitz survivor had just given a really touching speech. I mean, one thing that I hope comes of this now that it's kind of hopefully, I mean, just happening now is that this like farcical display of all these like bad guys just stops. Like, I feel like this has just started this pantomime, you know? And that's not to say that these people like Farage weren't completely awful human beings before Brexit, but I hope that there's gonna be less of this kind of like charade.
Yeah, I feel like, first of all, I would never place my money on the farcical display of bad guys ending. I think that's where, I think we're stuck with that.
Yeah.
But I do feel like, obviously there have always been bad politicians. I feel like there is a sort of joy, like that they have taken upon themselves over the past few years, because there are so many people, like including some young people, online people that just want to see their side sort of spit in the face of other people, and I think that that's led to a viciousness, that we haven't seen in a while, at least. So really fast, for the purposes of people at home who haven't necessarily been following the whole Brexit thing very much, we've heard for a long time about different forms of Brexit, usually measured by softness to hardness. This is the hard kind, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, we're still gonna be in trade talks. Freedom of movement is still happening. I think that you can only stay in European countries for 90 days, I think, without applying for a visa, I believe. But I don't know, lots of stuff remains to be seen, but you know, I feel like the actual most sort of day-to-day changes that most people are gonna feel soon is like their passport's gonna be blue. There's gonna be some Brexit 50p's. The hatred and the like horrible kind of I don't know, like fractured nature of the UK that happened after the referendum result. So I mean, that's just been something that people have been living with for years now.
Yeah. Do you think that after it happens, I saw it was some official in the UN was saying, oh yeah, inevitably the millennials are gonna hate this, it's gonna be terrible, and someday they will reverse it, I guess, the process you were talking about. It's been a big part of UK politics. There's been a lot of anger, but it's always been sort of like, what's gonna happen? Is it possible that once it's done and the effects actually sink in, could there be some sort of backlash, either politically in terms of support for the parties or possibly down the line reversing it?
I mean, I hope so. I think that there were so many lies fed to us throughout the campaign. Like the Leave campaign was a fraudulent campaign in my view. And we're now about to start paying the EU a bunch of like divorce money. I think that when people actually sort of like sit with the reality of what's happened and how completely pointless it was, that yeah, once people have got their energy back, we're talking about a nation that's been so fatigued by this thing for years and years, and the effects are so abstract. Mm-hmm. It's really difficult to determine how people actually feel about it. So yeah, I mean, I'm exhausted. And I don't even live in the UK anymore.
Exactly, you're a bit removed from it, and me even more so. So look, I want to turn now to the Royals drama. We've talked about it once or twice on the show. I've almost exclusively talked with Americans about it, and there are a lot of Americans, as I'm sure you know, who are obsessed with what's going on with the royal family.
Yeah.
And you don't live in the UK right now, but obviously you are from there. So I would like to get your perspective as a person with a far stronger connection to the actual place and to the family. What do you make of all of what's been going on in the past few weeks?
I mean, I've been finding it absolutely like riveting how it's unfolded in the UK media, just because I think it's brought these issues about white privilege and systemic racism to the mainstream media and to a lot of people have no idea what the hell they're talking about. Like there's just been so many angry white men on primetime TV being like, Britain's not racist. Like, what are you talking about? And it's just been, as someone my age, to watch like crazy. And it's so sort of obviously spells out this divide between the media that I consume and then the media that's, you know, the BBC or whatever. But I mean, in fact, one of the Labour leader candidates had a really sort of brilliant clash with Piers Morgan recently, a woman called Lisa Nandy, because he was saying, you know, the treatment of Meghan Markle is not racist. She had the same treatment as Kate Middleton, 70% positive and 30% negative, he said. And Lisa was just like, how the hell would you know? You're a privileged white man and you've never
had
to deal-
the most.
Yeah, exactly.
Outside of the royal family, perhaps. Did you see there was a mashup going around online? It was, it might have been Daily Mail, but it was headlines about Meghan Markle and headlines about Kate Middleton, about the same exact subject in each case, but totally different perspective on what it means for her to touch her stomach when she's pregnant, what it means for her to eat avocados. And it was just lauding Kate Middleton and downing on Meghan Markle for doing the exact same thing. I should send those to Piers Morgan. But I'm also curious, the one thing that I've been curious about, and I don't generally follow what's going on with the royals. After it was announced that they're leaving. It was sort of presented as, they've defeated the royals with sort of the assumption that it is very hard to leave. Why is that exactly? Like, if someone was part of the royal family and they wanted to be like, forget this, I'm living in Madagascar, why is that so difficult?
Well, I mean, for one, on a very basic level, they're living off taxpayers' money. So one of the first things that they've said that they're gonna do is pay back the money that they used to renovate their house, which was
That I didn't know. That's impressive.
I don't know I don't think that I'm going to be getting a rebate. Like, thanks, Harry and Meghan, but like they're supposedly giving the money back. But I mean, I don't know. It's public opinion. I'm very like anti-royal. I think the whole thing is absurd. And I, you know, I'm rooting for them. I have no idea why people are shocked that they would want to leave, that they want to go and live a normal life and like get away from that place. I think that it's just archaic, the whole system. And I feel like it's majority for show, you know. It feels like a sort of like tourism thing to me. I just I don't think that the Queen is relevant. I'm gonna get so much like hate mail now, aren't I?
Yeah, pro Queen forces. Queen
stands. I'm rooting for Meghan, and I just think that, you know, like you say, that mashup that you mentioned, all of the media like attacks on Meghan Markle is so kind of, you know, who the hell does she think she is, you know? And it's just so typical.
It's such a trope.
It's such a trope, such a cliched way to talk about a woman of color. And the fact that people are even trying to question that, or just, you know, even slightly deny it, I'm finding really funny. But like I say, it's fascinating to me because so many people are showing their true colors and just being like, oh, okay, you're just a really, really ignorant human being.
Yeah.
And that's quite a nice way to be able to weed them out.
Yeah. I can't imagine, considering all that's being discussed, the context around the situation, turning to Piers Morgan to understand. It seems like a crazy thing for any person to do. Billy Porter, great to have you in studio.
Thank you.
Always glad to talk to you. Hopefully we'll talk soon.
Yes.
And those of you at home, we still have one more segment. Meanwhile, in after this. And now it's time for news from around the world. And meanwhile, in the Arctic, that preview video has never been more appropriate. We are talking about polar bears, and they are in rough times. Not just because of climate change, as you might think, but also because there's still trophy hunting. And we have award-winning wildlife photographer and conservationist Ole Liodin, who's been working for 4 years on a project to highlight the issues of polar bears. Says that hunters are going around targeting the healthiest, strongest males for the most impressive trophies, which leaves only the weakest individuals to pass on their genes, while obviously simultaneously cutting down their numbers. He says we have to stop trophy hunting and the commercial skin trade. This is the only way that polar bears have a chance of survival in the future with global warming. Now, in terms of numbers, bear in mind nearly 9,000 polar bears were killed by hunters in the Arctic between 2007 and 2016, the most recent numbers. More than 50,000 have been killed since 1960. That is twice as many as today's entire remaining population. And with the numbers getting that low, we already have to look forward to climate change. The idea that in some parts of the Arctic, trophy hunting is still allowed, or at least officials look the other way, completely unacceptable. We are looking at a future that potentially has no polar bears, and that's no joke. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Greece, they've seen Donald Trump's border wall and they think, hey, that's cool, but what if it was in the ocean? They want to set up a 1.7 mile fence in the Aegean Sea off the Greek island of Lesbos within the next 3 months after they find a private contractor to build it. And for the same purpose as Trump's wall, they want to stop some of the inflow of migrants from across the Mediterranean. Give you an idea of how this is going to function. 1.7 miles out at sea, pretty significant. It's a net-like barrier that's going to rise 50 centimeters above the water and have flashing lights to make it visible at night. They're going to take a look at how it does. And if it's successful, they might add on to it to be up to 8 to 9 miles long. With the goal being of stopping small migrant carrying boats from being able to get by. Now, that's their plan. The plan is stop them from getting by. But think about that. People crowd onto these tiny little boats. This is their last chance to get across. They cross the Mediterranean in horrific conditions and then hit a fence that stops them. What happens after that? This isn't a cruise. They're not stocked up for months at sea. Best case scenario, they can go back across the Mediterranean to Africa. Many will probably die on that trip. If anyone survives at all, this is a situation that is explicitly setting up the mass murder of migrants trying to get into Europe. Nikos Panagiotopoulos, the country's defense minister, said it would act as a natural barrier. But it's not a natural barrier, it's an unnatural barrier that you are setting up. What a weird way to twist reality there. And bear in mind, nearly 60,000 migrants and refugees made the crossing to the islands off Greece. Nearly double recorded in 2018. So it is an issue. Letting them all die at sea, not the solution. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Mexico, specifically right near the border with California, take a look at this little video. Look at that creepy little tunnel. What's that? And what's that weird beeping? Well, what you're seeing there is a more than 4,300 foot tunnel across the border, the longest ever found. It was just discovered. It has a lift, a rail track, drainage and air ventilation systems, high voltage electrical cables, Taco Bell Express. You can get everything you need is gonna be in that tunnel. No, okay, so it's still obviously very rough to transition through there. And it was being hidden. Apparently, like investigators were getting close. There was fear it would be discovered. So hundreds of sandbags had been piled up to stop people from getting in. No arrests have been made, no drugs were found, and nobody, we don't know who exactly was operating it, although this is an area where the Sinaloa cartel operates. So it's possible that they had set it up, or at least co-opted it after it being constructed. Take a look at this map. To give you an idea, a more than 4,300 foot tunnel, 70 feet below the surface, 5 feet tall, 2 feet wide. That is a significant undertaking. And it's a reality of the situation, which again makes the idea that we're just going to wall off the entire border so ridiculous. Look at the lengths that people are willing to go to get by. Although honestly, sometimes you don't even need a 4,300 foot tunnel. Take a look at this video. Yeah, that's the wall falling over. You know why? Because of wind, which happens. That's Trump's wall. Ridiculous. Okay, thank you everybody. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.